Welcome to the Hoban Minute, a podcast that will shift your perspective on the business, politics, and culture of the hemp and marijuana industries. I'm your host, Xavier Jaye. It's 420 somewhere, so let's dive in. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Hoban Minute. I'm your host, Xavier, joined today, as I always am, by Bob Hoban. How are you today, Bob?
I'm well. How are you? What's going on?
I'm doing good, man. We had a nice little blizzard yesterday here in Denver, but it looks like the weather is going to be a little bit warmer moving forward, so I'm excited for spring to come around. Celebrate 420 outside, maybe.
That's right. Springtime in the Rockies. You never know what's going to come around.
Exactly. And I'm very excited to announce our guest today, Summer Westerber, who is the principal of Kairos Insurance Agency and a longtime cannabis industry professional. How are you today, Summer?
Doing well. How are you?
Doing good. Thank you. Very excited to talk to you today about a number of things. But, you know, the three of us had the opportunity, which we rarely do, to actually all be together in person last week at the NoCo Hemp Expo in Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor. And I thought we could start the conversation by maybe just a quick recap of our experiences there. I'll go ahead and start since I'm the one talking currently. And I was there Thursday, so I was just there for one day. I missed the missed kind of the opening remarks and statements and the welcome networking event, but I did have a chance to go to a little after party that was co-hosted by Clark Hill and Franny's Pharmacy. Great party they released and actually displayed and kind of did some samples of a new hemp pasta, which I thought was delicious. And then we went on to the first citizens networking event that night. We all had got together and celebrate the hemp industry. And so, you know, generally I thought the conference was great. It did seem like a unifying message was kind of the main theme of the conference. And it seemed like everyone left feeling, you know, maybe a little bit more positive than they were about the hemp industry going in. Any thoughts, Bob?
More positive or perhaps more divided than ever.
Well, yeah, I think the segments each identified their lanes and said, okay, that's my lane, I'm sticking to it.
Sure.
Which is maybe what they needed to do.
No, it's true. It was a really great event. The Broadmoor was a really, really great location and really representative of where NoCo as an event has come thus far. But, you know, there were some controversial topics and Delta 8, Delta 10, HHC, all of these compounds. The hemp industry doesn't like those things. The marijuana industry doesn't like those things. But they're the things that are making the most money among all right now. Yeah. And that's what the consumers want. So something's got to give. But that was part of the discussion last week. But, you know, it was great to get together with a lot of people. Summer, it was great to see you and Dr. Robert and so many other people. But what's your takeaway from the event?
So, I mean, I loved the event. I thought they did a great job. I think the most interesting part for me really is the industrial hemp industry, you know, just talking to you and Bo Whitney, just with climate change and everything, I just feel a lot more optimistic that we'll find solutions when I hear you talk, and really appreciated Jeff's talk. And of course, I thought the parties were great. Franny's party and that hemp pasta and the infused drinks. It was just great to be in Colorado and great to be with all of you.
It really was.
No, it was. And you know, let me just put a finer point for a moment on this divide type issue, right? Did the Farm Bill contemplate these types of extracts and derivatives like Delta 8, et cetera? That's where everybody comes back to. And you said, you know, one of the things I talked about was you have to embrace that. That's part of the family of uses for this plant. But people thought, no. Their immediate response was that's not what the Farm Bill intended. But we've talked about this before in summer, not to belabor this point because we've talked about it as well, but the Farm Bill language was about as broad as you possibly can make it. It says all salts,
derivatives, isomers,
all isomers, all compounds. I mean, they intentionally wrote it very broad so it doesn't encompass these things. So that created a divide. But, you know, Summer, to your point about the industrial uses, to meet so many people that have come so far in developing our national infrastructure and technology and different pieces of the puzzle that help make help bring hemp to really the forefront of what it's ultimately going to be used for. And that's, you know, some semblance of the 50,000 uses that are much lauded around this hemp plant. And that's ultimately what we're waiting for. But it's got to happen one step at a time.
It does. Yeah. And it absolutely will need to. And I think, you know, one thing that our last guest and I were talking about, Eric Singular, was just kind of how these various segments need to maybe find a home in more traditional industries that will easily integrate, you know, whatever offering of those 50,000, you know, magical uses of the hemp plant, whatever that segment's offering, they need to find that lane that already exists and kind of plug into it. So the plastics, for example, need to, you know, find folks that are looking to reduce carbon footprint with their plastics and then interject hemp into that process. So,
well, and just one quick note on that. One of the things that I observed was every hemp company, when you look at the concept of ESG, was trying to figure out how they adopt ESG principles when that's not necessarily what they need to be doing. They need to show larger companies, bigger fish, that hemp or what their solution through hemp is providing is actually an ESG component for the larger companies. So it's kind of flipping the script. And that wasn't so obvious to most in attendance. But, you know, Summer, we've talked a lot about ESG too. That was certainly a concept and a topic that was, you know, prevalent at the Hemp Expo. Hemp is uniquely situated and suited for ESG purposes. What's your thinking on hemp and how it fits in that regard?
I mean, it's a topic I know least about in our industry, but it's also the part that I'm most excited about. But, you know, actually, I'm always more curious to hear your thoughts on it. I usually take notes when we're talking about it.
Well, I think
Barcelona, I actually was sitting with Bo taking notes on this topic, but there's just so much to learn on it.
Yeah, and I think Europe is really going to be the driving force for a lot of ESG that we see, or ESG initiatives that we see globally as the last 5-6 years of the political climate here in the U.S. have indicated the U.S. is not going to be the leader when it comes to ESG initiatives globally. But, you know, I think ESG is actually, or governance specifically, is a great segue into, you know, kind of your story, Summer, your entrance into cannabis. You know, you are an insurance agent, one of the few that's able and licensed to work with cannabis operators. And so maybe you can tell us a little bit about, you know, your entry into the industry, kind of what initially brought you to cannabis, and when you identified that need for, oh, hey, these cannabis operators, you know, they're legitimate businesses with employees and they need insurance. So maybe you can tell us a little about that.
Sure. So, I mean, I started my health insurance agency in 2004. So I specialize in employee benefits. So a lot of people think that I do workers' comp or liability, but I really just focus on the health insurance side. I grew up in the industry. My mom owned a health insurance agency. I began working at that in Boca Raton when I was 13 years old. So originally I just had a Colorado traditional insurance agency. I guess, 2004 was when I opened, and then Colorado obviously became the first rec state. And I did identify a need with cannabis companies. It was very challenging at the time because most of them, as you know, were cash. And I think you know this about me, that I usually have several things going on. I was also doing mortgages at the time. And at that time I was, you know, getting mortgages for cannabis employees who are paid in cash. And it's interesting because back then we could do a loan for somebody who, you know, had W-2 income from cannabis, but not an owner. Health insurance was similarly complicated. Even today, we have carriers who won't accept clients, dispensaries for health insurance. And in the early days, it was a lot of predatory insurance plans. You know, I don't know if you know anything about these indemnity plans, but they maybe if you're in the hospital, the bill's $10,000 a night, they'll reimburse you $200 or $300 and pay the rest. The Division of Insurance doesn't really have much control over these products to regulate them. And the insurance companies that sell those very quickly realized that the cannabis industry was a great target because, you know, originally carriers didn't want to accept them and they didn't have options. Right. So I used my connections with insurance companies and started to get these through underwriting. It was kind of on a case-by-case basis back at that time. I had some difficult conversations with the insurance commissioner, you know, about putting a cannabis leaf next to my logo. That wasn't a very popular idea. And I couldn't get it in writing. But we, you know, he agreed that it would be okay. Verbally. And so it was, you know, I went through the same issues, I think, that a lot of cannabis companies go through. I had bank accounts closed once I put that cannabis logo on my business cards, which I think is interesting because I get paid through United Healthcare, Blue Cross, right? Like big companies, not through cannabis companies. And they did shut down my bank accounts. So the early days were definitely challenging.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll never forget. I mean, you know, as listeners of the show know, I was a bud tender and working in extraction labs in Colorado, and I used to get paid in money orders. And, you know, there certainly were no benefits involved with that employment. It was, you know, I was laughed out of the room if I asked about that. And so I still remember the day where it was like, oh, we have benefits coming. And we're like, wow, this is amazing. So it certainly has been kind of a long, as everything related to money and finances that touches cannabis is, it's been a long process to actually get, you know, these legitimate business operators the protections and the, you know, the benefits and the things that traditional businesses are able to offer their employees.
You know, but Summer, yeah. when you talk about health insurance and you talk about, you know, mortgages and that other scenario, what's the first inquiry with a provider or a carrier or a, you know, a lender, I suppose, in the mortgage context? Is it, this is illegal, how do we handle this? Or is it, you know, these businesses aren't legal, so we can't insure people that work for an illegal business. What's the sort of the first element of conversation? Because I think it's an interesting one. You've ultimately bridged through it, but where does it start?
So it's banking laws, right? So even today, and some of it's just policy. So for example, most of the major carriers in Colorado are issuing health insurance, but we just had a new insurance carrier come into the market, and I submitted a group, you know, 100 employees. They refused to quote it, so they're, you know, new to the state. They haven't been doing it. So sometimes it's corporate policy, but usually it's regulation. And I still find it difficult actually to place disability coverage. So short-term and long-term disability, I can only get through one carrier in Colorado. So I can get the medical, dental, vision now, but not the disability. And on the life insurance side, it's interesting because I can do life insurance with no problem for the employees, but I can't do a buy-sell agreement. And I know, Bob, you do M&A, so you understand a buy-sell agreement is crucial for, you know, a business owner. And life insurance companies will not write them if more than 51% of the income comes from a cannabis business owner. So, you know, sometimes agents will get it by using the spouse's income or, you know, all these different ways, but it's, they won't write it.
And so kind of, you know, continuing on that thought process, this podcast has been referred to as a crash course in cannabis MBAs. Where's the kind of the need currently when it comes to cannabis businesses and operators? Where's the blind spots that they aren't considering when it comes to, you know, costs and insurance and benefits they're able to offer to their employees?
So this is, I think, what's really important right now is I see a lot of companies who just, you know, they don't always have an HR department, right? And they grow fast. And so you'll see a lot of these companies going with a payroll company. And one of the big name ones, I won't say their name, just decided to drop all of their cannabis clients. But I will go in.
I think that was related to SVB, too. SVB Bank, right? I think, not to cut you off, I believe that company had all their cannabis accounts in SVB.
I think it began to become fractured when the cashless ATM issue came up, I do believe you're correct.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So, you know, what I see is just businesses paying too much for health insurance, and this is a significant cost, right? So you're talking, you know, maybe it's 40 employees and, you know, $20,000 or $30,000 a month, you know, more employees, obviously more expensive. And I see companies sign up with a payroll company, and that payroll company may have one or two or three plans, but they don't have hundreds of plans like broker has. And also they don't have the access usually to do level funded. So these are like partially self-funded health plans. And these are plans that we use in Colorado down to 10 employees now. They are medically underwritten. They're governed by ERISA instead of the ACA. They're just a lot more flexible, and the rates tend to be, for a healthier group, significantly lower. And I just don't see companies utilizing services. And sometimes it's just that they don't want the headache of logging into the carrier website and enrolling the employees. Sometimes they just want one-stop shopping, but it's such a significant cost that it really does need to be shopped every year.
You brought up something interesting about, you know, kind of healthier populations, obviously getting those lower rates. Generally in cannabis, do you see, like, are the employee pools and populations, is it largely, you know, younger, healthier people? Like, is there some sort of demographic line running on through that?
It absolutely is. And I have a lot of renewals coming up right now, and it's, you know, I think probably 80% of my cannabis companies are on partially self-funded plans. They also get a refund at the end of the year, you know, so one of my groups just got a $28,000 refund.
Wow.
You know, if their claims are lower than expected. So, Yeah, I really, the problem we do run into in cannabis is participation. So if a company is contributing, say, 50%, and let's say the employee only rate is 350, getting, you know, most carriers require 50 or 75% of the eligible employees to enroll. And occasionally that can be a challenge.
That's interesting. I wonder if that's like just the, you know, kind of the stigma that we see that, you know, continues to attach itself to cannabis, of the legacy operator and kind of the aversion of institutions and standard kind of traditional, I don't know, offerings, right? So it's like cannabis employers are like, well, we don't need benefits. We don't want our names on these papers.
Well, we don't need benefits, but I also wonder if the notion about the cannabis industry is, well, they're in the cannabis industry, they must use cannabis, and therefore they must be unhealthy, which it doesn't sound like that's the case at all. I mean, you know, that cynical approach to, oh, cannabis users or anybody using any sort of substance, they must naturally be unhealthy. Summer, you ever hear anything or run across that to the point where they're surprised when they see that it is a young, healthy population that generally works at these stores and the like and in these businesses?
No, but if I ever do, I will use the data that you and Bo gave me that states that legalize have 10% lower medical claims.
Yeah, no, and I would, you know, obviously I would stake put my stake in the dirt and argue the exact opposite of what you're just saying, Bob, and that, you know, cannabis users are far healthier than any other population. So hopefully the insurance companies can learn up or can smarten up to that sooner rather than later.
There's actually one product that I think you'll be interested in. This is not for cannabis companies specifically, but I'm starting to sell a CBD insurance, and it's one of the first that I've seen. And I'm selling this to, you know, other types of law firms and, you know, people who aren't like us getting CBD at wholesale from friends or whatever.
Yeah, no.
But people who work,
people who work with their bodies. Right, right.
Yeah.
And the fact that employees are able to, you know, our companies are able to offer these benefit programs to employees that include cannabinoid therapies, CBD products, as part of their benefit offering. It's great.
And Bob, one of the questions I have for you about that is somebody asked me, you know, what about, you know, how do you think large corporations, let's say with government contracts, how do you think that they will respond to those products?
Well, you know, interestingly, I had a great conversation with some military veterans that were talking about this concept in the context of the VA. And, you know, if something's illegal at the federal level, it really comes down to how is it tested, right? So if ultimately it's illegal, I do believe that larger organizations are simply going to treat it as an illegal thing. And marijuana is illegal. CBD is a legal substance, but it's not yet regulated. And that lack of legal understanding between that distinction of what's legal and what's regulated or not regulated oftentimes leads people to say, well, CBD is illegal. No, CBD is not illegal. It, to the contrary, it's 100% federally legal, and it's regulated in multiple states, but it's not yet regulated by the FDA. So that's sometimes some of the pushback that you're going to get is ultimately they're going to say it's not legal. Well, it's not regulated. That doesn't make it not legal. It means that the regulatory agency was moving too slow. In other countries around the world, if something's not regulated, then, you know, don't dare put it into commerce because you can go to jail. In the United States, the penalties are so much lighter and really non-existent, mostly as a practical matter, that the industry exists with the tacit approval of the prior two FDA commissioners. So it's a strange situation, but it does lead some people to conclude that CBD is therefore illegal. So, you know, that might be something you see, but and it's certainly something we've had to work on from a legal opinion perspective.
And I wonder if this circles back to ESG, right? And maybe, you know, it comes down to the ESG policies of the company and the corporation. And I could see a large company like Dr. Bronner's, sure, offer some CBD products to their employees, right? Famously an advocate for the cannabis industry. And so there's opportunities out there. And I think it'll come down to, you know, some companies being the leaders and the pioneers, like everything else in cannabis, and taking that initial risk.
Well, and meanwhile, workers' compensation programs in multiple states will reimburse you for medical right. cannabis, medical marijuana, yet not for CBD. So a lot has to happen.
Right. Right. And I guess it's the...
So I'm actually going to take that data from our group, you know, and take it to the insurance companies. When we're doing these level funded plans, they're looking at the claims for the last 12 months, the last 24 months. So I'm curious, you know, if we have this conversation in a couple of years, I'll be curious what we find.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back on in a year or so and get some updates on that. I want to pivot briefly to another topic that I know you're very passionate about, Summer. And that's kind of the inclusion of women executives and women-owned businesses in the cannabis space. You recently authored an article that was published, I believe, on MJ Biz Daily, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, it's fantastic. That discussed, you know, the lack of women representation in the boardroom when it comes to cannabis companies. You and I were just chatting before we went live here, and you mentioned that last year's MJ BizCon, only 5% of the companies that were exhibiting or attending, I can't remember which one it was, were, you know, women owned. So maybe you can talk to us a little bit about, you know, kind of that issue and some proposed solutions and ways that the industry can stand behind women executives and continue to make the space more inclusive to you know, women, but also everyone. Make sure that anyone that's able and willing to run a business, you know, is able to access those resources and kind of get in.
Yeah, so definitely. That article was co-authored with Sarah Bodner from Golden State Public Affairs. It is in MJ Biz, if anybody wants to read it. I think that it's interesting because we are a community of activists, and I think it would be difficult to find an industry that actually cares more about women in leadership. But at the same time, we're a startup industry, right? And so access to capital is going to historically, right, be with more men. So I think it's definitely what we need to be talking about. I think, you know, I think men can play a large role in this, right? I mean, but you guys have done this for me over the years, you know, giving me introductions to people in the industry. It's little things like that I think make all of the difference.
Well, and there's always more to the story with the data, right? If you walk MJ BizCon and whatever the number was, say 5% are female-led or owned businesses, well, it could be that those 5%, those companies have been there for five or six MJ BizCons in a row, whereas the other 95% of male-run companies, they're flashes in the pan. They're there one year, they're gone the next, nobody ever hears from the people again. So, you know, it could be a story of longevity and sustainability too, when you dig a little bit deeper, but certainly that the playing field needs to be leveled. And there's a number of organizations that try to do that. But like so many things in the cannabis industry, everybody's got their own perspective and their own ego and their own way to do that. And, you know, groups that seek to promote and, you know, sort of elevate and educate women across the board in this industry are no different. Have you seen any of that infighting with, you know, you don't have to name names, but have you seen organizational infighting? Because I always see this with certain sub communities within cannabis, that the communities don't necessarily get their act together, not because of the motivation or the activism or the effort. It's because there's five organizations trying to do the same thing and they can never get on the same page, largely because of ego.
Well, I think that's, you know, I think there is something to that. And I also think, you know, sometimes we were just talking about this, but sometimes these events, you know, that are for women only actually end up taking us out of events, you know, where we need to be in sort of mixed gender spaces, right? Like, so yes, I do think that that we need to be more unified in it. But I think at the end of the day, for me personally, it's not about being involved in women-only organizations. I just like to be in a room with cannabis people, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a lot that can be done, not just from the individuals and the companies, but from a regulatory and policy perspective too, you know, with the social equity components that we're starting to see actually, you know, finally take effect and be utilized in this industry. We're starting to see, you know, women-owned certifications be included as qualifying certifications for, you know, social equity provisions. And so I think certain states are starting to actively look at, you know, that disproportionate percentage of ownership and say, okay, we need to actually do something here and be a little bit more involved and active in this process to ensure that, you know, women are more involved in the industry.
So I think that's a great point, because I think what we saw in New Jersey with the social equity grants, you know, they're doing, I think, two different programs, $150,000 and $250,000. These aren't specific to women. These are social equity, but I think something similar to that for women in cannabis, right? We know we need more women in cannabis. We know access to capital is a problem. I think programs like that are helpful.
Yep, absolutely. And you mentioned New Jersey briefly. You know, I do want to give you the opportunity to maybe share with the audience some of the things that you're currently working on. Because as I understand it, you know, it's not just insurance that you're doing, but you are involved in various ventures in the cannabis space. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Well, so this is the first time I'm telling people that I have my retail license in New Jersey that obviously you guys helped me obtain. And yeah, I'm very excited. I'm moving across the country in a week and a half. I've always wanted to live in the Northeast, and I'm very excited to move over to the plant touching side. And, you know, a lot of my clients were very helpful with getting to this point, but obviously it's mostly you guys who've been supporting me through this process, and I'm very excited.
Well, how appropriate that you're moving to the plant touching side of the business in the Garden State of all places, my home state as well. And I'm pretty excited about it. I mean, look, it's the most densely populated state in the country. Cannabis use is rampant. I do believe that that market will present tremendous commercial and you know, financial benefits for those that do go in and build it right. And I know you're in the throes of that, but tell us a little bit about your move and you know, how that has and will change your life.
So I've just always wanted to live there. You know, divorced parents, single parents, custody. I was always
in
Colorado,
New Jersey.
I always wanted to live in New York, and so as long as I'm very close to New York,
there we go.
But yeah, it's exciting. I'm you know, I think opening a retail store will be, you know, great, and I'm really excited to be in a new cannabis community. You know, where there's, I mean, I've been out there quite a bit now for the, you know, local approval things and the. Just some of the getting involved with the chamber. I'm on the board of the Tri-State Cannabis Chamber of Commerce. And so I've been out for quite a few meetings, and it's just the energy of, you know, a new market. And I'm excited for that.
I will say that the industry in New Jersey does appear to be, you know, rallying around itself in a way that I haven't really seen in any other state, you know, as far as service providers, ancillary businesses, you know, legal services, of course, all these groups are coming together and really planting their flag in the ground as cannabis first. And we just see, you know, more often than not, we get folks that, you know, dip a toe in the industry and say, okay, yeah, I'm working with cannabis operators, but really not to the way that we're kind of seeing this unification in New Jersey. So I'm truly excited to see, you know, the future potential of that market, and then kind of what we can accomplish there.
They really do seem to have a community growing. And I mean, considering how few stores are open, I'm very excited about that.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that. We're very excited for you. But, you know, this has been an interesting conversation and kind of walk through some various challenges and kind of still areas of improvement that remain, let's say, available in the cannabis industry. It's amazing kind of learning more about yourself and the way that you're pushing the envelope in some of these areas. You know, you've dropped some great knowledge today regarding insurance and some of the ways that operators can reduce cost. You know, folks that do have questions for you, where can they find you, Summer?
So summerlesterber.com is my website. It has links to all of my businesses.
And Summer, just to put a finer point as we wrap up here, we'll talk about this in more detail again, but where can they find your CBD company? And it's not just any kind of CBD company. Just for a minute, tell us a little bit about the CBD company and where they can find those products.
So the CBD company, so the founders of that are myself and then Sarah that I mentioned earlier, and Robert Cohen, who, as you know, is the founder of one of the first cannabis medical practices in Colorado. Simcha Life.com is the website, and we have a kosher certified CBD, and we also have a CBG product. I'm excited to also take that to the Northeast.
Yeah, and that'll be popular in the Northeast, given the large Jewish community up there. I mean, I can't imagine there's going to be lots of consumers looking for, you know, cannabis products that do meet that kosher standard. So I think it's again one of those kind of interesting entrepreneurial use cases where, you know, you've identified kind of this, you know, some might think narrow market segment, but really it's not narrow, and there's no one else doing it. So I think it's a fantastic opportunity.
That was the most fun project I've worked on. You know, it's insurance is very boring. I've done it my entire life. And I only enjoy it now because I work with interesting people doing great work in cannabis. But, you know, designing that brand and labels and, you know, finding the best products, it really was a lot of fun.
Well, Summer, you've said it all. We covered a lot. Always good to connect with you. SummerWesterber.com. Xavier, bring us home.
Listen, that was a true pleasure, Summer. I hope you have a great rest of the day here, and we are looking forward to having you on again in the future.
Thank you so much.
Bye now. Thanks for joining us for another enlightening conversation. If you liked what you heard, hit that subscribe button to get all future episodes fresh out of the studio. Suggestions for topics or guests for the show, please send them to hello@bobhoban.com. And as always, thanks to Benzinga for powering the Hoban Minute.